This is Audible.
Duets, a division of Full Cast Audio, presents A Long Walk to Water by Linda Sue Park.
Chapter 1, Southern Sudan, 2008. Going was easy. Going, the big plastic container held only air. Tall for her 11 years, Nia could switch the handle from one hand to the other, swing the container by her side, or cradle it in both arms. She could even drag it behind her, bumping it against the ground, and raising a tiny cloud of dust with each step. There was little weight going. There was only heat. The sun already baking the air, even though it was long before noon. It would take her half the morning if she didn't stop on the way. Heat, time, and thorns.
Southern Sudan, 1985. Salva sat cross-legged on the bench. He kept his head turned toward the front, hands folded, back perfectly straight. Everything about him was paying attention to the teacher. Everything except his eyes and his mind. His eyes kept flicking toward the window, through which he could see the road. The road home. Just a little while longer, a few minutes more, and he would be walking on that road. The teacher droned on with the lesson about the Arabic language. Salva spoke the language of his Dinka tribe at home, but in school he learned Arabic, the official language of the Sudanese government, far away to the north. 11 years old, on his last birthday, Salva was a good student. He already knew the lesson, which was why he was letting his mind wander down the road, ahead of his body. Salva was well aware of how lucky he was to be able to go to school. He could not attend the entire year, because during the dry season his family moved away from their village. But during the rainy season, he could walk to the school, which was only half an hour from his home. Salva's father was a successful man. He owned many head of cattle and worked as their village's judge, an honored, respected position. Salva had 3 brothers and 2 sisters. As each boy reached the age of about 10 years, he was sent off to school. Salva's older brothers, Arik and Ring, had gone to school before him. Last year it had been Salva's turn. His 2 sisters, Akit and Agnath, did not go to school. Like the other girls in the village, they stayed home and learned from their mother how to keep house. Most of the time, Salva was glad to be able to go to school. But some days he wished he were still back at home herding cattle. He and his brothers, along with the sons of his father's other wives, would walk with the herds to the water holes, where there was good grazing. Their responsibilities depended on how old they were. Salva's younger brother, Kuol, was taking care of just 1 cow. Like his brothers before him, he would be in charge of more cows every year. Before Salva had begun going to school, he had helped look after the entire herd, and his younger brother as well. The boys had to keep an eye on the cows, but the cows did not really need much care. That left plenty of time to play. Salva and the other boys made cows out of clay. The more cows you made, the richer you were. But they had to be fine, healthy animals. It took time to make a lump of clay look like a good cow. The boys would challenge each other to see who could make the most and best cows. Other times, they would practice with their bows and arrows, shooting at small animals or birds. They weren't very good at this yet, but once in a while they got lucky. Those were the best days. When one of them managed to kill a ground squirrel or a rabbit, a guinea hen or a grouse, the boys' aimless play halted, and there was suddenly a lot of work to do. Some of them gathered wood to build a fire. Others helped clean and dress the animal. Then they roasted it on the fire. None of this took place quietly. Salva had his own opinion of how the fire should be built and how long the meat needed to cook, and so did each of the others.
The fire needs to be bigger. It won't last long enough. We need more wood.
No, it's big enough already.
Quick, turn it over before it's ruined.
The juices dripped and sizzled. A delicious smell filled the air. Finally, they couldn't wait one second longer. There was only enough for each boy to have a few bites, but oh, how delicious those bites were. Salva swallowed and turned his eyes back toward the teacher. He wished he hadn't recalled those times, because the memories made him hungry. Milk. When he got home, he would have a bowl of fresh milk, which would keep his belly full until supper time. He knew just how it would be. His mother would rise from her work grinding meal and walk around to the side of the house that faced the road. She would shade her eyes with one hand, searching for him. From far off, he would see her bright orange headscarf, and he would raise his arm in greeting. By the time he reached the house, she would have gone inside to get his bowl of milk ready for him. Crack! The noise had come from outside. Was it a gunshot, or just a car backfiring? The teacher stopped talking for a moment. Every head in the room turned toward the window. Nothing. Silence. The teacher cleared his throat, which drew the boy's attention to the front of the room again. He continued the lesson from where he had left off. Then, crack! Pop, pop, crack! Ack, 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 ack! Gunfire.
Everyone down!
The teacher shouted. Some of the boys moved at once, ducking their heads and hunching over. Others sat frozen, their eyes and mouths open wide. Salva covered his head with his hands and looked from side to side in panic. The teacher edged his way along the wall to the window. He took a quick peek outside. The gunfire had stopped, but now people were shouting and running.
"Go quickly, all of you,"
the teacher said, his voice low and urgent.
"Into the bush, do you hear me? Not home. Don't run home. They will be going into the villages. Stay away from the villages. Run into the bush."
He went to the door and looked out again.
"Go! All of you! Now!"
The war had started 2 years earlier. Salva did not understand much about it, but he knew that rebels from the southern part of Sudan, where he and his family lived, were fighting against the government, which was based in the north. Most of the people who lived in the north were Muslim, and the government wanted all of Sudan to become a Muslim country, a place where the beliefs of Islam were followed. But the people in the south were of different religions and did not want to be forced to practice Islam. They began fighting for independence from the north. The fighting was scattered all around southern Sudan, and now the war had come to where Salva lived. The boys scrambled to their feet. Some of them were crying. The teacher began hurrying the students out the door. Salva was near the end of the line. He felt his heart beating so hard that its pulse pounded in his throat and ears. He wanted to shout,
"I need to go home! I must go home!"
But the words were blocked by the wild thumping in his throat. When he got to the door, he looked out. Everyone was running, men, children, women carrying babies. The air was full of dust that had been kicked up by all those running feet. Some of the men were shouting and waving guns. Salva saw all this with one glance. Then he was running too, running as hard as he could into the bush, away from home.
Chapter 2, Southern Sudan, 2008. Nya put the container down and sat on the ground. She always tried not to step on the spiky plants that grew along the path, but their thorns littered the ground everywhere. She looked at the bottom of her foot. There it was, a big thorn that had broken off right in the middle of her heel. Nya pushed at the skin around the thorn. Then she picked up another thorn and used it to poke and prod at the first one. She pressed her lips together against the pain.
Southern Sudan, 1985.
Boom!
Salva turned and looked. Behind him, a huge black cloud of smoke rose. Flames darted out of its base. Overhead, a jet plane veered away like a sleek, evil bird. In the smoke and dust, he couldn't see the school building anymore. He tripped and almost fell. No more looking back. It slowed him down. Salva lowered his head and ran. He ran until he could not run any more. Then he walked, for hours, until the sun was nearly gone from the sky. Other people were walking, too. There were so many of them that they couldn't all be from the school village. They must have come from the whole area. As Salva walked, the same thoughts kept going through his head in rhythm with his steps.
Where are we going? Where is my family? When will I see them again?
The people stopped walking when it grew too dark to see the path. At first, everyone stood around uncertainly, speaking in tense whispers or silent with fear. Then some of the men gathered and talked for a few moments. One of them called out,
"Villages! Group yourselves by villages! You will find someone you know!"
Salva wandered around until he heard the words,
"Lone Arik! The village of Lone Arik! Here!"
Relief flooded through him. That was his village. He hurried toward the sound of the voice. A dozen or so people stood in a loose group at the side of the road. Salva scanned their faces. There was no one from his family. He recognized a few people, a woman with a baby, two men, a teenage girl, but no one he knew well. Still, it was comforting to see them. They spent the night right there by the road, the men taking shifts to keep watch. The next morning, they began walking again. Salva stayed in the midst of the crowd with the other villagers from Lone Arik. In the early afternoon, he saw a large group of soldiers up ahead. Word passed through the crowd.
"It's the rebels!"
The rebels. Those who were fighting against the government. Salva passed several rebel soldiers waiting by the side of the road. Each of them held a big gun. Their guns were not pointed at the crowd, but even so, the soldiers seemed fierce and watchful. Some of the rebels then joined the back of the line. Now the villagers were surrounded.
"What are they going to do to us? Where is my family?"
Late in the day, the villagers arrived at the rebel camp. The soldiers ordered them to separate into two groups, men in one group, women and children and the elderly in the other. Teenage boys, it seemed, were considered men, for boys who looked to be only a few years older than Salva were joining the men's group. Salva hesitated for a moment. He was only 11, but he was the son of an important family. He was Salva Mawian Dut Arik, from the village named for his grandfather. His father always told him to act like a man, to follow the example of his older brothers and, in turn, set a good example for Kuol. Salva took a few steps toward the men.
"Hey!"
A soldier approached Salva and raised his gun. Salva froze. All he could see was the gun's huge barrel, black and gleaming, as it moved toward his face. The end of the barrel touched his chin. Salva felt his knees turn to water. He closed his eyes.
"If I die now, I will never see my family again."
Somehow, this thought strengthened him enough to keep him from collapsing in terror. He took a deep breath and opened his eyes. The soldier was holding the gun with only one hand. He was not aiming it. He was using it to lift Salva's chin so he could get a better look at his face.
"Over there," the soldier said.
He moved the gun and pointed it toward the group of women and children.
"You are not a man yet. Don't be in such a hurry."
He laughed and clapped Salva on the shoulder. Salva scurried over to the women's side. The next morning, the rebels moved on from the camp. The village men were forced to carry supplies, guns and mortars, shells, radio equipment. Salva watched as one man protested that he did not want to go with the rebels. A soldier hit him in the face with the butt of a gun. The man fell to the ground, bleeding. After that, no one objected. The men shouldered the heavy equipment and left the camp. Everyone else began walking again. They went in the opposite direction from the rebels, for wherever the rebels went, there was sure to be fighting. Salva stayed with the group from Lone Arik. It was smaller now, without the men, and except for the infant, Salva was the only child. That evening they found a barn in which to spend the night. Salva tossed restlessly in the itchy hay.
Where are we going? Where is my family? When will I see them again?
It took him a long time to fall asleep. Even before he was fully awake, Salva could feel that something was wrong. He lay very still with his eyes closed, trying to sense what it might be. Finally, he sat up and opened his eyes. No one else was in the barn. Salva stood so quickly that for a moment he felt dizzy. He rushed to the door and looked out. Nobody. Nothing. They had left him. He was alone.
Chapter 3 Southern Sudan, 2008. The smudge on the horizon gained color as Nia drew nearer, changing from hazy gray to olive green. The dirt under her feet turned to mud, then sludge, until at last she was ankle deep in water. There was always so much life around the pond. Other people, mostly women and girls, who had come to fill their own containers. Many kinds of birds, all flap and twitter and caw. Herds of cattle that had been brought to the good grazing by the young boys who looked after them. Nia took the hollowed gourd that was tied to the handle of the plastic container. She untied it, scooped up the brown, muddy water, and drank. It took two gourdfuls before she felt a little cooler inside. Nia filled the container all the way to the top. Then she tied the gourd back in place and took the padded cloth donut from her pocket. The donut went on her head first, followed by the heavy container of water, which she would hold in place with one hand. With the water balanced on her head and her foot still sore from the thorn, Nia knew that going home would take longer than coming had. But she might reach home by noon, if all went well.
Southern Sudan, 1985. The tears were hot in Salva's eyes. Where had everyone gone? Why had they left without waking him? He knew the answer. Because he was a child, who might tire easily and slow them down, and complain about being hungry, and cause trouble somehow.
I would not have been any trouble. I would not have complained. What will I do now?
Salva took a few steps to see what he could see. On the far horizon, the sky was hazy from the smoke of the bombs. About 100 paces in front of him, he could see a small pond. Between the pond and the barn was a house. And yes, a woman sitting in the sun. Holding his breath, he crept closer until he could see her face clearly. The ritual scar patterns on her forehead were familiar. They were Dinka patterns, which meant that she was from the same tribe as Salva. Salva let out his breath in relief. He was glad that she was not Nuer. The Nuer and the Dinka had a long history of trouble. No one, it seemed, was sure where Nuer land ended and Dinka land began. so each tribe tried to lay claim to the areas richest in water. Over the years, there had been many battles, large and small, between Dinka and Nuer. Many people on both sides had been killed. This was not the same as the war that was going on now between the rebels and the government. The Dinka and the Nuer had been fighting each other for hundreds of years. The woman looked up and saw him. Salva flinched at her glance. Would she be friendly to a stranger? Would she be angry with him for spending the night in her barn? But at least he was not alone now, and that knowledge was stronger than the uncertainty about what the woman might do or say to him. He walked toward her.
"Good morning, Auntie,"
he said, his voice trembling. She nodded at him. She was old, much older than Salva's mother. He kept quiet, waiting for her to speak.
"You must be hungry," she said at last.
She stood and went into the house. A few moments later, she came back out and gave him two handfuls of raw peanuts. Then she sat down again.
"Thank you, Auntie."
Squatting on his haunches next to her, Salva shelled the nuts and ate them. He chewed every nut into a paste before he swallowed, trying to make each one last as long as he could. The woman sat without speaking until he was finished. Then she asked,
"Where are your people?"
Salva opened his mouth to speak, but his eyes filled with tears again, and he could not answer. She frowned.
"Are you an orphan?"
He shook his head quickly. For a moment he felt almost angry. He was not an orphan. He had a father and a mother. He had a family.
"I was at school. I ran away from the fighting. I do not know where my family is."
She nodded.
"A bad thing, this war. What are you going to do? How will you find them?"
Salva had no answer. He had hoped that the woman might have some answers for him. After all, she was an adult. Instead, she had only questions. Everything was upside down. Salva stayed in the woman's barn again that night. He began to make a plan.
"Maybe I can stay here until the fighting stops. Then I will go back to my village and find my family."
He worked hard so she would not send him away. For 3 days he fetched firewood from the bush and water from the pond. But the pond was drying up. Each day it was harder to fill the gourds. During the daytime, Salva could hear the distant booming of artillery from the fighting a few miles away. With every shell that exploded, he would think of his family, hoping they were safe, wondering desperately when he would be with them again. On the fourth day, the old woman told him that she was leaving.
"You have seen that the pond is only a puddle now. Winter is coming, and the dry season, and this fighting."
She nodded her head in the direction of the noise.
"I will go to a different village near water. You cannot stay with me any longer."
Salva stared at her as panic rose inside him.
"Why can't I go with her?"
The woman spoke again before he could ask aloud.
"The soldiers will leave me alone, an old woman on her own. It would be more dangerous for me to travel with you."
She shook her head in sympathy.
"I am sorry, I cannot help you anymore," she said.
"Wherever it is you walk, just be sure to walk away from the fighting."
Salva stumbled back to the barn.
"What will I do? Where will I go?"
The words repeated themselves 1,000 times in his head. It was so strange. He had known the old woman for only a few days, but now he could not imagine what he would do once she was gone. He sat inside the barn and stared out, looking at nothing. As the light grew dimmer, the noises of evening began. The buzz of insects, the rustling of dry leaves, and another sound.
Voices?
Salva turned his head toward the sound. Yes, it was voices. Some people were walking toward the house, a small group, fewer than a dozen. As they approached, Salva took a sharp breath. In the fading light he could see the faces of those nearest him. Two of the men had patterns of V-shaped scars on their foreheads. Dinka patterns again, the kind that were given to the boys in Salva's village as part of the ritual of becoming a man. These people were Dinka too. Could his family be among them?
Chapter 4. Southern Sudan, 2008. Nya's mother took the plastic container from her and emptied the water into three large jars. She handed Nya a bowl of boiled sorghum meal and poured a little milk over it. Nya sat outside in the shade of the house and ate. When she was done, she took the bowl back inside. Her mother was nursing the baby, Nya's little brother.
"Take a care with you,"
her mother said, nodding toward Nya's sister. Glancing at her younger sister, Nya did not say what she was thinking, that a care, who was only 5 years old, was too small and walked too slowly.
"She needs to learn," her mother said.
Nya nodded. She picked up the plastic container and took a care by the hand. Home for just long enough to eat, Nya would now make her second trip to the pond. To the pond and back, to the pond and back. Nearly a full day of walking altogether. This was Nya's daily routine, 7 months of the year. Daily. Every single day.
Southern Sudan, 1985. Salva held his breath as he scanned the faces, one by one. Then the air left his lungs and seemed to take all hope with it. Strangers. No one from his family. The old woman came up behind him and greeted the group.
"Where are you going?"
she asked. A few of the people exchanged uneasy glances. There was no reply. The woman put her hand on Salva's shoulder.
"This one is alone. Will you take him with you?"
Salva saw doubt on the people's faces. Several men at the front of the group began speaking to each other.
"He is a child. He will slow us down."
"Another mouth to feed? It is already hard enough to find food."
"He is too young to do any real work. He'll be of no help to us."
Salva hung his head. They would leave him behind again, just as the others had. Then a woman in the group reached out and touched the arm of one of the men. She said nothing, but looked first at the man and then at Salva. The man nodded and turned to the group.
"We will take him with us," he said.
Salva looked up quickly. A few in the group were shaking their heads and grumbling. The man shrugged.
"He is Dinka,"
he said, and began walking again. The old woman gave Salva a bag of peanuts and a gourd for drinking water. He thanked her and said goodbye. Then he caught up with the group, determined not to lag behind, not to complain, not to be any trouble to anyone. He did not even ask where they were going, for fear that his questions would be unwelcome. He knew only that they were Dinka and that they were trying to stay away from the war. He had to be content with that. The days became a never-ending walk. Salva's feet kept time with the thoughts in his head, the same words over and over.
"Where is my family? Where is my family?"
Every day he woke and walked with the group, rested at midday, and walked again until dark. They slept on the ground. The terrain changed from scrub to woodland. They walked among stands of stunted trees. There was little to eat. A few fruits here and there, always either unripe or worm rotten. Salva's peanuts were gone by the end of the third day. After about a week, they were joined by more people, another group of Dinka and several members of a tribe called the Jurchol. Men and women, boys and girls, old and young, walking, walking, walking to nowhere. Salva had never been so hungry. He stumbled along, somehow moving one foot ahead of the other, not noticing the ground he walked on or the forest around him or the light in the sky. Nothing was real except his hunger, once a hollow in his stomach, but now a deep buzzing pain in every part of him. Usually he walked among the Dinka, but today, shuffling along in a daze, he found he had fallen a little behind. Walking next to him was a young man from the Jurchol. Salva didn't know much about him, except that his name was Buxa. As they walked along, Buxa slowed down. Salva wondered sluggishly if they shouldn't try to keep up a bit better. Just then, Buxa stopped walking. Salva stopped too. But he was too weak and hungry to ask why they were standing still. Buxa cocked his head and furrowed his brow, listening. They stood motionless for several moments. Salva could hear the noise of the rest of the group ahead of them, a few faint voices, birds calling somewhere in the trees. He strained his ears. What was it? Jet planes? Bombs? Was the gunfire getting closer instead of farther away? Salva's fear began to grow until it was even stronger than his hunger. Then, ah! A slow smile spread over Buxa's face.
There! You hear?
Salva frowned and shook his head.
Yes, there it is again. Come!
Buxa began walking very quickly. Salva struggled to keep up. Twice Buxa paused to listen, then kept going even faster.
What?
Salva started to ask. Buxa stopped abruptly in front of a very large tree.
Yes, he said. Now go call the others.
By now, Salva had caught the feeling of excitement.
But what shall I tell them? The bird, the one I was listening to, he led me right here.
Buxa's smile was even bigger now.
You see that?
He pointed up at the branches of the tree.
Beehive! A fine, large one!
Salva hurried off to call the rest of the group. He had heard of this, that the Jurchol could follow the call of the bird called the Honey Guide, but he had never seen it done before. Honey. This night, they would feast.
Chapter 5, Southern Sudan, 2008. There was a big lake 3 days' walk from Nya's village. Every year when the rains stopped and the pond near the village dried up, Nya's family moved from their home to a camp near the big lake. Nya's family did not live by the lake all year round because of the fighting. Her tribe, the Nuer, often fought with the rival Dinka tribe over the land surrounding the lake. Men and boys were hurt and even killed when the two groups clashed. So Nya and the rest of her village lived at the lake only during the 5 months of the dry season, when both tribes were so busy struggling for survival that the fighting occurred far less often. Like the pond back home, the lake was dried up. But because it was much bigger than the pond, the clay of the lake bed still held water. Nya's job at the lake camp was the same as at home, to fetch water. With her hands, she would dig a hole in the damp clay of the lake bed. She kept digging, scooping out handfuls of clay, until the hole was as deep as her arm was long. The clay got wetter as she dug, until, at last, water began to seep into the bottom of the hole. The water that filled the hole was filthy, more mud than liquid. It seeped in so slowly that it took a long time to collect even a few gourdfuls. Nya would crouch by the hole, waiting. Waiting for water. Here, for hours at a time. And every day for 5 long months, until the rains came. And she and her family could return home.
Southern Sudan, 1985. Salva's eye was swollen shut. Buxa's forearms were lumpy and raw. A friend of Buxa's had a fat lip. They all looked as though they had been in a terrible fist fight. But their injuries weren't bruises. They were bee stings. A fire had been started under the tree to smoke the bees out of the hive and make them sleepy. But as Buxa and the other Jurchol men were removing the hive from the tree, the bees woke up and were not at all happy to discover that their home was being taken away. They expressed their unhappiness very clearly by buzzing, swarming, and stinging. Stinging a lot.
It was worth it,
Salva thought as he touched his eye gingerly. His belly was a rounded lump stuffed full of honey and beeswax. Nothing had ever tasted so good as those pieces of honeycomb dripping with rich, luscious gold sweetness. Along with everyone else in the group, he had eaten as much as he could hold, and then a little more. All around him, people were licking their fingers in great satisfaction, except for one Dinka man who had been stung on his tongue. It was swollen so badly that he could not close his mouth. He could hardly swallow. Salva felt very sorry for him. The poor man couldn't even enjoy the honey. The walking seemed easier now that Salva had something in his belly. He had managed to save one last piece of honeycomb and had wrapped it carefully in a leaf. By the end of the next day, all the honey was gone, but Salva kept the beeswax in his mouth and chewed it for the memory of sweetness. The group got a little bigger with each passing day. More people joined them, people who had been walking alone or in little clusters of two or three. Salva made it a habit to survey the whole group every morning and evening, searching for his family. But they were never among the newcomers. One evening, a few weeks after Salva had joined the group, he made his usual walk around the fireside, scanning every face in the hope of seeing a familiar one. Then,
ouch!
Salva almost lost his footing as the ground underneath him seemed to move. A boy jumped to his feet and stood in front of him.
Hey, that was my hand you stepped on!
The boy spoke Dinka, but with a different accent, which meant that he was not from the area around Salva's village. Salva took a step back.
Sorry, are you hurt?
The boy opened and closed his hand a few times, then shrugged.
It's all right, but you really should watch where you're going. Sorry,
Salva repeated. After a moment's silence, he turned away and began searching the crowd again. The boy was still looking at him.
Your family?
He asked. Salva shook his head.
Me too,
the boy said. He sighed, and Salva heard that sigh all the way to his heart. Their eyes met.
I'm Salva. I'm Marial.
It was good to make a friend. Marial was the same age as Salva. They were almost the same height. When they walked side by side, their strides were exactly the same length. And the next morning, they began walking together.
Do you know where we are going?
Salva asked. Marial tilted his head up and put his hand on his brow to shade his eyes from the rising sun.
East, he said wisely. We are walking into the morning sun.
Salva rolled his eyes.
I know we are going east, he said. Anyone could tell that. But where in the east?
Marial thought for a moment.
Ethiopia,
he said.
East of Sudan is Ethiopia.
Salva stopped walking.
Ethiopia? That is another country. We can't walk all the way there.
We are walking east, Marielle said firmly.
Ethiopia is east.
I can't go to another country,
Salva thought.
If I do, my family will never find me.
Marielle put his arm around Salva's shoulders. He seemed to know what Salva was thinking, for he said,
It doesn't matter. Don't you know that if we keep walking east, we'll go all the way around the world and come right back here to Sudan? That's when we'll find our families.
Salva had to laugh. They were both laughing as they started walking again, arm in arm, their strides matching perfectly. More than a month had passed since Salva had run from his school into the bush. The group was now walking in the land of the Atwat people. In the Dinka language, the Atwat were called the People of the Lion. Their region was inhabited by large herds of antelope, wildebeest, gnus, and the lions that preyed on them. The Dinka told stories about the Atwat. When an Atwat person died, he came back to earth as a lion, with a great hunger for the human flesh he once had. The lions in the Atwat region were said to be the fiercest in the world. Nights became uneasy. Salva woke often to the sound of roars in the distance, and sometimes to the death squeal of an animal under a lion's claws. One morning he woke bleary-eyed after a poor sleep. He rubbed his eyes, rose, and stumbled after Mariel as they began walking yet again.
Salva?
It was not Mariel who had spoken. The voice had come from behind them. Salva turned. His mouth fell open in amazement, but he could not speak.
Salva!
Chapter 6 Southern Sudan, 2008. Nya's family had been coming to the lake camp for generations. Nya herself had been there every year since she was born. One thing she liked about the camp was that even though she had to dig in the clay and wait for water, she did not have to make the two long trips to the pond every day. But this year, she realized for the first time that her mother hated the camp. They had no house and had to sleep in makeshift shelters. They could not bring most of their things, so they had to make do with whatever was at hand. And for much of each day, they had to dig for water. But the worst was the look on her mother's face when Nya's father and older brother, Deb, went off to hunt. Fear. Her mother was afraid. Afraid that the men in the family would run into Dinka tribesmen somewhere, that they would fight and get injured, or worse. They had been lucky all these years. No one from Nya's family had been hurt or killed by Dinka. But she knew other families in the village who had lost loved ones in this way. Nya could see the questions in her mother's face every morning. Would they be lucky again? Or was it now their turn to lose someone?
Southern Sudan, 1985. Salva's mouth closed and opened again, as if he were a fish. He tried to speak, but no sound came out of his throat. He tried to move, but his feet seemed stuck to the ground.
Salva!
The man said again, and hurried toward him. When the man was only a few steps away, Salva suddenly found his voice.
Uncle!
He cried out, and ran into the man's arms. Uncle Jawir was the younger brother of Salva's father. Salva hadn't seen him in at least 2 years. Because Uncle had been in the army.
Uncle must know about the war and the fighting. Maybe he will know where my family is.
But these hopes were dashed as soon as Uncle spoke.
Are you alone? Where is your family?
He asked. Salva hardly knew where to begin his answer. It seemed like years since he had run away from his school and into the bush. But he told his uncle everything as best he could. As Salva spoke, Uncle nodded or shook his head. His face became very solemn when Salva told him that he had not seen nor heard a single word of his family in all that time. Salva's voice trailed off, and he lowered his head. He was glad to see Uncle again, but it looked as if he might not be much help either. Uncle was quiet for a moment. Then he patted Salva's shoulder.
"Hey, nephew," he said in a cheerful voice. We are together now, so I will look after you.
It turned out that Uncle had joined the group 3 days earlier, but since there were more than 30 people traveling together, they had not found each other until now. As they began walking, Salva saw that Uncle had a gun, a rifle that he carried on a strap over one shoulder. Already, Salva could tell that because of his army experience and because he had a gun, Uncle was seen by the group as a kind of leader.
"Yes, when I left the army, they let me keep my rifle," Uncle said. "So I'm going to shoot us a fine meal as soon as we come across anything worth eating."
Uncle was true to his word. That very day he shot a young antelope, the kind called a topi. Salva could hardly wait for it to be skinned and butchered and roasted. As the smoky, meaty aroma filled the air, he had to keep swallowing the saliva that flooded his mouth. Uncle laughed as he watched Salva gobble down his first piece of the meat.
"Salva, you have teeth. You are supposed to use them when you eat."
Salva could not reply. He was too busy stuffing another chunk of the delicious charred meat into his mouth. Even though the topi was a small one, there was more than enough meat for everyone in the group. But it did not take long for Salva to regret his haste in eating. After so many weeks of near starvation, his stomach rebelled mightily. He spent most of the night vomiting. Salva was not alone. Whenever his heaving stomach woke him, he would hurry to the edge of the camp to vomit and find others there doing the same. At one point, Salva found himself in a line of half a dozen people, all in an identical pose, bent over, holding their stomachs, and waiting for the next wave of nausea. It might have been funny if he hadn't felt so miserable. The group continued to walk through the land of the Etwat. Every day they saw lions, usually resting in the shade of small trees. Once, in the distance, they saw a lion chasing a topi. The topi escaped, but along the path Salva saw the bones of prey that had not been so fortunate. Salva and Marielle still walked together, staying close to Uncle. Sometimes Uncle would walk with the other men and talk seriously about the journey. At those times, Salva and Marielle would drop back respectfully, but Salva always tried to keep Uncle in sight, and he slept near Uncle at night. One day the group began walking in the late afternoon, with hopes of reaching a water hole before settling down for the night. But there was no water anywhere, though they searched for miles. They kept walking into the night and through the night. For 10 hours they walked, and by dawn, everyone was exhausted. Uncle and the other leaders finally decided that the group had to rest. Salva took 2 steps off the path and fell asleep almost before he lay down. He did not wake until he felt Uncle's hand shaking his shoulder. As he opened his eyes, he heard wailing. Someone was crying. Salva blinked away the sleepiness and looked at Uncle, whose face was very solemn.
"I am sorry, Salva," Uncle said quietly. "Your friend."
"Marielle?"
Salva looked around.
"He should be somewhere nearby. I don't remember if he slept near me. I was so tired. Perhaps he has gone to find something to eat."
Uncle stroked Salva's head as if he were a baby.
"I am sorry,"
he said again. A cold fist seemed to grip Salva's heart.
Chapter 7 Southern Sudan, 2008. Nya sat on the floor. She reached out and took her little sister's hand. Akea did not seem to notice. She lay curled on her side, hardly moving, silent except for an occasional whimper. Her silence frightened Nya. Only 2 days earlier, Akea had complained noisily and at length about the pains in her stomach. Nya had been annoyed by all the whining. Now she felt guilty, for she could see that her sister no longer had enough strength to complain. Nya knew many people who suffered from the same illness. First cramps and stomach ache, then diarrhea, sometimes fever, too. Most of the adults and older children who fell ill recovered, at least enough to work again, although they might continue to suffer off and on for years. For the elderly and for small children, the illness could be dangerous. Unable to hold anything in their systems, many of them starved to death, even with food right in front of them. Nya's uncle, the chief of their village, knew of a medical clinic a few days' walk away. He told Nya's family that if they could take a care there, doctors would give her medicine to help her get better. But a trip like that would be very difficult for a care. Should they stay at the camp and let her rest so she might heal on her own? Or should they begin the long, hard walk and hope they reached help in time?
Southern Sudan, 1985. The walking began again. Salva shook with terror, inside and out. He clung to Uncle like a baby or a little boy, hanging onto his hand or shirt tail when he could, never letting Uncle get farther than an arm's length away. He looked around constantly. Every movement in the grass was a lion stalking. Every stillness, a lion waiting to spring. Marielle was gone, vanished into the night. He would never have wandered away from the group on his own. His disappearance could mean only one thing. Lion. A lion had been hungry enough to approach the group as they slept. A few men had been keeping watch, but in the dark of night, with the wind rippling through the long grass, the lion could easily have crept close without being seen. It had sought out prey that was small and motionless. Marielle, sleeping. And it had taken him away, leaving only a few splotches of blood near the path. If it hadn't been for Uncle, Salva might have gone crazy with fear. Uncle spoke to him all morning in a steady, low voice.
Salva, I have a gun. I will shoot any lion that comes near. Salva, I will stay awake tonight and keep watch. Salva, we will soon be out of lion country. Everything will be all right.
Listening to Uncle, hurrying to stay close to him, Salva was able to make his feet move despite the cold terror throughout his whole body. But nothing was all right. He had lost his family, and now he had lost his friend as well. No one had heard any screaming in the night. Salva hoped, with all his heart, that the lion had killed Marielle instantly, that his friend hadn't had time to feel fear or pain. The landscape grew greener. The air smelled of water.
The Nile, Uncle said. We will soon come to the Nile River and cross to the other side.
The Nile, the longest river in the world, the mother of all life in Sudan. Uncle explained that they would come to the river at one of its broadest stretches.
It will not even look like a river. It will look like a big lake. We will spend a long time crossing to the other side.
And what is on the other side?
Salva whispered, still fearful.
Desert, Uncle answered.
And after that, Ethiopia.
Salva's eyes filled with tears. Marielle had been right about Ethiopia.
How I wish he were here, so I could tell him I was wrong.
Salva stood on the bank of the Nile. Here, as Uncle had said, the river formed a big lake. The group would cross the Nile in boats, Uncle said. It would take a whole day to reach the islands in the middle of the lake, and another day to get to the far shore. Salva frowned. He saw no boats anywhere. Uncle smiled at Salva's puzzled expression.
What? You didn't bring your own boat? He said. Then I hope you are a good swimmer.
Salva lowered his head. He knew that Uncle was teasing, but he felt so tired. Tired of worrying about his family. Tired of thinking about poor Marielle. Tired of walking and not knowing where they were going. The least Uncle could do was tell him the truth about the boats. Uncle put his arm around Salva's shoulders.
You'll see.
We have a lot of work to do.
Salva staggered forward with yet another enormous load of reeds in his arms. Everyone was busy. Some people were cutting down the tall papyrus grass by the water's edge. Others, like Salva, gathered up the cut stalks and took them to the boat builders. Among the group were a few people whose home villages had been near rivers or lakes. They knew how to tie the reeds together and weave them cleverly to form shallow canoes. Everyone worked quickly, although there was no way of knowing whether they had to hurry or not, no way of knowing how near the war was. The fighting could be miles away, or a plane carrying bombs could fly overhead at any moment. It was hard work, running back and forth between those cutting and those weaving, but Salva found that the work was helping him feel a little better. He was too busy to worry much. Doing something, even carrying big, awkward piles of slippery reeds, was better than doing nothing. Every time Salva delivered a load of reeds, he would pause for a few moments to admire the skills of the boat builders. The long reeds were laid out in neat bunches. Each end of a bunch would be tied together tightly. Then the bunch of reeds was pulled apart in the middle to form a hollow, and the two sides were tied all along their length to make a basic boat shape. More layers of reeds were added and tied to make the bottom of the boat. Salva watched, fascinated, as little by little, the curve of a prow and low sides grew from the piles of reeds. It took 2 full days for the group to build enough canoes. Each canoe was tested. A few did not float well and had to be fixed. Then more reeds were tied together to form paddles. At last, everything was ready. Salva got into a canoe between Uncle and another man. He gripped the sides of the boat tightly as it floated out onto the Nile.
Chapter 8 Southern Sudan, 2008. It was like music, the sound of Akair's laugh. Nia's father had decided that Akair needed a doctor. So Nia and her mother had taken Akair to the special place, a big white tent full of people who were sick or hurt, with doctors and nurses to help them. After just 2 doses of medicine, Akair was nearly her old self again, still thin and weak, but able to laugh as Nia sat on the floor next to her cot and played a clapping game with her. The nurse, a white woman, was talking to Nia's mother. "Her sickness came from the water," the nurse explained. "She should drink only good, clean water. If the water is dirty, you should boil it for a count of 200 before she drinks it." Nia's mother nodded that she understood, but Nia could see the worry in her eyes. The water from the holes in the lake bed could be collected only in tiny amounts. If her mother tried to boil such a small amount, the pot would be dry long before they could count to 200. It was a good thing, then, that they would soon be returning to the village. The water that Nia fetched from the pond in the plastic jug could be boiled before they drank it. But what about next year at camp? And the year after that? And even at home, whenever Nia made the long, hot walk to the pond, she had to drink as soon as she got there. She would never be able to stop Akair from doing the same.
Southern Sudan, 1985. The lake's surface was calm, and once the boats had pulled away from the shore, there was not much to see. Just water and more water. They paddled for hours. The scenery and motion were so monotonous that Salva might have slept, except he was afraid that if he did, he might fall over the side. He kept himself awake by counting the strokes of Uncle's paddle